Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and I'm going to keep the intro very tight today. I'm going to keep it tight. I've said I normally say I'm going to keep it tight, but today I'm going to keep it tight. Kurt Fernley. Kurt Fernley is back. He was on episode 11 of Willosophy back in the day, one of the first people who came to my house and did an episode with me, and it is brilliant to catch up with him for episode, I don't know, 150-odd. I haven't counted, but it's something like that these days. So it's a very different time in Kurt's life, and it was great to check back in to see his reflections on what had happened in between and where he was now in his life. And he's always just one of the best people to talk to, Kurt. He is an absolute sporting legend. He's a three-time Paralympic gold medalist, two-time Commonwealth gold medalist, and of course won the gold medal at the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast, which was probably the highlight of those entire Commonwealth Games. He's won over 30 marathons in his life, including the New York, Chicago and London Marathon. He's an incredible disability advocate. He's doing incredible work in the community. He's hilarious and interesting and wonderful. Anyway, you won't find a bigger fan of Kurt Fernley than me, and I'm so pleased to have the great man back on my podcast, but check out his Tiny Island. It's an absolute cracker. So speaking of websites, you can go to patreon.com/willosophy and support this little podcast. The fact that it's coming out often twice a week at the moment is a bit of an experiment for what we are aiming to do if we can hit the $5,000 a month mark on the Patreon, which we are going towards. Thank you to everybody who in these hard times has found a little bit of money and has joined up to support this show. If we can get it up to the $5,000 mark, we've budgeted that we can pay Podcast Mike, who puts out these episodes for me, and James Fosdyke to do all the original art, and we can go with two a week. And our aim is, if we get to that $5,000, we'll do one original episode a week and one repeat guest, one check-in with a former guest of the podcast per week. So you can do that by going to patreon.com/willosophy. And thank you to all the people who messaged me there. I'm trying not to read social media at the moment, just for mental health reasons. Trying not to check in too much on, Twitter and Facebook and all those sort of things. But I am trying to read all the messages that come to the Patreon page, and there's been some incredible ones, people sharing their stories, their insights, and of course, incredibly as well, people suggesting really cool guests for the podcast. So I've got a really good list of people. I always love when somebody's like, oh, this person is from my area of the world and they're a brilliant speaker and they've got an incredible story, and follow them on Twitter or, look up their website and have a look and see if they would be a good guest for the podcast. So I'm making a really good list of people from the Patreon suggestions as well. So keep them coming. Speaking of the podcast, the ASRC, the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, an incredible organisation that do work for asylum seekers in our community in Australia. And I auctioned off an opportunity to appear as a guest on this podcast, and somebody, an anonymous person, I haven't found out who they are yet, bid $6,550 for that. So thank you to that incredibly generous person. $6,550 going to help asylum seekers and the incredible work that the ASRC do in our community. So thank you so much for that, and thank you to those who bid and supported. And I know it very quickly got to an amount of money that most people could not afford, but the fact that somebody came in and bid so much money to appear on this podcast, I look forward to finding out who it was, and I look forward to recording that interview and sharing it with you all as well sometime in the future. That's it. See, I told you I was going to keep it short. I'm going to keep it under 4 minutes. So I hope you enjoy this one with Kurt. If you do, let him know, and let me know via the Patreon as well, and enjoy this episode. This is Kurt. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Here's something I've been doing during this quarantine period. One of the only rules I have with this podcast, and people, you might be a new listener to the show. Welcome if you are. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for finding the podcast. Thanks for whoever shared it with you in the first place. That meant that you found it this late into the game. We're somewhere in the episode 150s. I don't know the exact number that we've done, but I think we're in the 150s. At the moment, but I started this show 6-7 years ago, and I didn't really know what it was back then. What I really did was I just thought, I've got a bunch of interesting friends that I would like to talk to, and I'll start with just talking to some of my interesting friends. And during this quarantine period, when I can't be face-to-face in a room with somebody to do one of these shows, what I've been doing is revisiting previous guests on the show. This one, this is very exciting today because this is like getting in a time machine. I did a little Google because I knew you were one of the early episodes, but I did a little Google of my timeline to find out when it was that we actually recorded our episode with today's guest. And it was over 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago, we had a chat. It was episode 11 of what has become this Willosophy show. And I am very pleased to have my friend back on the show today. This is how the show starts. I don't even know if it's... I think it's how it started back then as well. I'm not even really sure. It was so long ago. But I ask my guest who they are. So who are you?
I'm Kurt Fernley. Has been. Has been. That look. Used to... Used to race wheelchairs. Now figuring it out.
I mean, it is actually quite interesting that we speak so far apart because I know that you're joking, but but I guess last time we spoke, you know, in some ways you were at the peak of your athletic powers. Perhaps, you know, like with an eye on when it was all going to finish up, you know, but you'd established your fame and legend and, you know, built your career, and we spoke about all those things. And now I'm catching up with a bloody has-been.
Yeah. When we chatted last time, it was 2014, the end of 2014, I think, maybe the start of 2015. Yeah. So you were in between cycles, and I was just ramping up for my final Paralympics. So I was in the zone. And it's funny because that next 18 months was the last period of time that the hunger was almost undisputed. Like there was no other conflict in me. That's what I wanted to do. I was a wheelchair racer. And then I would make it through to Rio, and in the final 200 meters of the Rio Games, something clicked and it said that you don't need this anymore. And once that's done, it's done. But I would race for another 2 years after that. But really, I know the exact moment. It was maybe even 150 meters to go. But it was, I was leading right up until then. A competitor would start to go by me. And for the very first time, my head just said, you don't need this. And yeah. So since then, I've been slowly working into my comfort levels of being Kurt Fernley has been.
So Kurt Fernley has been. It's so lovely to see you. You're drinking a tiny coffee. Can we talk about that before we get to the other stuff? What is this tiny coffee that you are drinking on screen? It's almost like you have stolen like a teacup from your child's like playset to drink a coffee in this morning.
Look, I think that it's because you're looking at me through a screen, and I have two things, giant hands and a giant head. So the proportions are all out of whack for you. But I am an espresso drinker, and I just find that nothing gets the heart started than my teeny weeny little puddle of black.
And what I enjoy about it, though, is, and again, we're going to get onto more important things, but let's start with this. We're recording this early in the morning. We're both drinking coffee, but I'm just enjoying the way you drink coffee because I have got like a regular size coffee here in front of me. And like normally it takes me about 3 sips to get through this regular size, where I've seen you've taken at least 18 sips of the world's tiniest coffee. Like it's just like you're miming drinking coffee. There cannot still be coffee left in that cup with the amount of sips you've taken so far.
You know what's going to blow your mind? It's only started halfway full. I don't know what I do, but there are so ever since me and Sheridan were together, we've always had our coffee at 6 o'clock in the morning, and now it's always at 6:30 in the morning. But now I just drink coffee from 6:30 until I feel awake. So this is coffee number 3, I think, and I find there are a few just pure joys. There are a few things in the world that I love more than just waking up in my own time and just enjoying a coffee. And I don't scull it like you, Anderson. I sit there and I enjoy it. No matter how little, I'm going to sip away at this thing for the next hour just to prove my point.
All right. So
delicious.
The pleasures of life is an interesting thing to talk about, because let's talk a bit about what's happened in those 5 years. And the most obvious one, obviously, you know, for everybody in the world right now is the idea that we're still in the middle of a global pandemic. And, you know, Australia is slowly coming out of, you know, a quarantine state, but has been in a quarantine state. What was that period of time like for you?
I learnt quite a lot about myself over the last few months. One is that I actually learnt that I miss people. I miss them. I spent a lot of time, so from the moment that Rio was done, or even especially when the Commonwealth Games were done, I spent my life on the road, at just working, just going into rooms of 1,000 people, and by the, you know, end of the year, I kind of would be exhausted and not want to be around people. And people laugh at me, my friends laugh at me about how antisocial I am, that I've got this core group of friends, and, you know, I'm the person that goes into a pub and I will find the darkest corner with that group and pull them in and just not leave my place. Over this period of time, I have missed the interaction with people. I remembered the last time that I shook hands was March 13th. It was with driver Steve, and that day I got home and it felt like just the world fell apart. the next day, I think it was Friday the 13th, and Monday the 15th of March, just everything, all work disappeared, 8 months just in a blink, and it felt like the world.
I remember it was Friday the 13th too, because I absolutely remember this. I was at the Adelaide Fringe Festival, and that was the day they cancelled the Melbourne Comedy Festival, Friday the 13th, and I knew as soon as they cancelled the Melbourne Comedy Festival, that meant all my touring for the entire year was basically going to be done. And like you, I remember distinctly Friday the fucking 13th.
It was like just surreal. Yeah. So my wife got let off that day as well. And I remember, just sitting there and wondering, well, like, I hadn't stopped since I was 13. I kind of knew where I was going for so long, and I kind of thrived on this constant momentum, and I don't do bored very well. I don't do nothing very well. And then, everything just stopped. And then even going down the street, my community is quite close. I know Newcastle. When I would go down the street, you would just get such a positive interaction with everybody. Everyone was saying hello. And then over that 3 weeks, it just turned into cold, and everybody was a bit scared. And, you know, like, it was just there, I just disliked that period of time. I disliked the whole quarantine more than what I could have ever imagined. And work-wise, you know, I shifted everything over that next 3 weeks, and I came out the other side of quarantine, I think, doing completely different things to what I was doing on the way into it. Like, so we figured it out. But I still, and there are positives that I will look back on in, you know, years to come, to say that the time that I spent with the kids and these little crazy little things that I did during that period of time. But in general, I'm not a fan of people being scared, community being scared, and it stung me a bit.
And how do you feel about the general community level when it comes to being scared at the moment? Because obviously there's the virus, but there just seems to be an immense amount of fear in our society in general. You know, some of it quite founded fears. When you talk about, you know, the Black Lives Matters, for example, protests, you know, they're based on, you know, legitimate concerns about deep-set problems in our society, and for the people who are in those marginalised communities, legitimate fears every day for their safety and their life and their well-being. They're real fears. The fears around the climate, particularly that the younger generation are staring down and, you know, having to go, what is the world that I'm going to look like in, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? There's a lot of fear around that. I feel like with the internet and the amount of information we're getting and the sensational nature of all the information, because it's competing for our eyeballs, everything's presented in such a sensational way, that also ramps up fear. And so many dying old school news models, the more that their audience goes to these newer models, the more they rely on what they used to rely on, which was, if it bleeds, it leads, you know, create fear, create panic. That's how we sell newspapers or get people to watch the news. I sense fear everywhere at the moment. Do you feel like that's how we're living as a society?
Absolutely. And I detest fear. I've always just, when I am afraid of something, I run against it. I do it. You know, like it's probably been one of the driving parts of who I am, that if something shakes me, I try and head towards it. Where at the moment there is fear everywhere. And I probably for the first time in my life, I've felt fear without the knowledge that there's an exit strategy or there's a way to get through it. It's made me, this period of time has made me look at, I always think about the social contract, that it's made me reassess my own kind of social contract about how everybody's social contract is so completely different than each other's, but we all in the edges of it, we all actually have the same one. So my one affects yours, yours affects the person that's next to you. That it all kind of has this overlapping context, and my social contract overall is awesome. There are some bits that I would love to get rid of. The bits that, you know, someone has the ability to kick me out of an airline or a pub or you know, a mode of transport because of who I am. That's a shit part of the contract that I haven't been able to adjust so far. But that part of mine should affect yours as well. And I think trying to get our community to realize that there are a big bunch of our community whose contract is shit right now. It's average. That their contract means that when they go into a shop, they get doubt about their presence. And we don't like to say this as being, you know, that's not racism or anything, because when we talk about racism, when you talk about racism to people that aren't affected by it, it's like this dark cloud that they would have carried around if they're a racist. You know, it's the stain on the soul. They would know if they're a racist. But like when you're discriminated against because of who you are, like me, that when somebody discriminates against me because I'm in a chair, they don't know that they're doing it. There's no siren that goes off when that happens. And it's not a dark cloud. It's one interaction that for that person is over and they walk away. For me, I carry that for the rest of my life. So during this period of time, it's made me realize that, you know, when you see so many people who are negatively affected by race, their contract is affecting mine and yours. Their contract is shit. And maybe we're going to be able to talk about that a little bit more. Maybe now there's going to be a bit more truth about that, because I grow up, I love this country. Awesome country. It has given me so much. But if somebody else's contract is not right, then mine's a bit shit too.
Also, and what you said about loving the country, and I think that this is, you know, something that often is, I don't know, weaponized against people who look for improvements in the country, that somehow that means that you don't like it or love it or appreciate, you know, what you've got from it. you know. No, I think that it's the complete opposite of that. I'm incredibly grateful for the myriad of opportunities that this country and the people of this country have afforded me. And my hope for it to be better for everybody and more equal for everybody and for everybody to be able to have opportunity to have that experience is only because I want it to be better. It doesn't mean that I don't appreciate what it has been for me. I would like it to for everybody to have that same opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But it's used in a different way by some, I would think, that it's this person who wants to change it, they're going to take something away from you, and it's just false. So the only fear, I see hope in these protests. I see good will come from the protests. I still have the fear of this virus, though, which wreaked havoc with my life, your life, huge chunks of our country from March, from March 13th and onwards, and it's still there, and it can still at some point potentially rip our comfort and put fear back in everyone's day-to-day life. We're in one of the most fortunate positions right now that we're down to single digit numbers potentially almost nationwide daily. We're the envy of the majority of the world, except for Kiwis, those bastards. They do everything so bloody good. But it's still caution that it's there and that it can. It doesn't see justice. It doesn't see right, wrong. It just sees an opportunity and it'll multiply.
It's hard because, we are reopening, and I think that there is some value in them dipping their toe back in the water to see what that looks like and what shape it can take. But some people have mistaken that for thinking that it's over, and it may not be over. Our best case scenario is that it is, or it is at least manageable in a way, and all the things that we put in place will continue to manage it. But until there's a vaccine, until there's a cure for the disease, it is never over. And you only have to look to other countries and to see how their populations have been decimated and they've not been able to get on top of them to understand that's true. So I think that's the hard thing about something that goes for this long, is that you don't just get one tragedy at a time. And maybe this is something that you can speak about as well, because I think sometimes we have this naive idea that if your house burns down in the bushfire, that's your one for the year. But the people whose house burnt down in the bushfires, they also had to deal with the effects of coronavirus, of COVID, on top of what they were already dealing with. And then, these the Black Lives Matter protests, these, protests against this inequality around the world are important to have, but unfortunately they are still happening in the middle of a global pandemic. Both of those things are true at the same time.
Yeah, so when it first hit as well, one of my fears were how it would play its course in the developing world. I've got this interaction with the school. They've got the Kurt Fernley Centre in it, 75 kids with disabilities in one of the slums in Kenya, in the suburbs of Nairobi. And I had an interaction with the school in Syria back in 2009. I spent some time in it in the Yarmouk camp, and beautiful kids speaking about getting kids with disabilities into a mainstream school. It was just incredible. And then the world fell apart in Syria, and I saw that it just fell apart. We were getting emails from the staff saying, please help, please help. And then it just stopped overnight, somewhere around 2011 or 12, just stopped. And I started to get messages from the slum, from Ruben Center, and it was about, just when we have a quarantine, people nick all the dunny paper and the shells in Woolies or Coles or whatever. Their lockdown was that if you go outside, you're beaten by police with batons. If you're living on a few dollars a day that you sell, seeds and whatever it is on the street, if that's taken away from it, you don't eat. So my fear was that it's going to just decimate communities over there. So far, thankfully, so far, we've been able to increase a level of funding and give them give the community hope and existence through this period of time. But they don't just have one tragedy. They never have, ever. People deal with exponential amounts of tragedy. And I think one of the reasons why I think that there was this panic buying in the weeks before Corona had hit is that we haven't had to deal with that. And this period of time has made us deal with the concept of death, where in the developing world, death is prevalent, that you deal with death day in, day out. It's just where it is, where in places like Australia, a death is a tragedy, as it always is. But it's so, I don't know, we haven't really had to deal with it on the same basis that they're now still dealing with it in the US. 800 people a day are still dying from this disease. And I think that it really rocked a lot of this country, because it's just so foreign. We don't die from, accidents. We don't die from, you know, things as easily accessible as what COVID was, and as large a scale as what COVID was. So yeah, that it's funny. My work over in the challenging parts of the world probably equipped me with the knowledge that shit can go bad real quick.
So tell me about that work, where it's happening, and why it was firstly that you wanted to do it, and what the experiences are like.
The reason why I wanted to work, it's almost, I know it's terrible to think, it's bang for your buck, that if you've got a limited amount of time to go in and create change, you can create a massive amount of change in a limited time frame in countries where purely the existence of people with disabilities into mainstream schools is a foreign concept. So the presence of a person who is a teacher, who is educated, who is a proud person with a disability, can create change through presence, through it being the visual presence that you were just landing in a slum or a refugee camp that can give. So going through a decade of limited time up my sleeve, but the desire to still be a teacher, or the desire to still work around the education system, that was just the most meaningful thing that I could do with the time that I had.
Hey mate, just give me a second. This is great, but my dog's just going crazy, so I'm just going to quickly check what's going on.
Go for it. You're in the COVID-19 black tie pajamas. I love it.
Oh mate, yeah, I'm definitely in my pajamas. I have not had a shower. I apologise for that. I've just rolled out of bed. I've rolled down to the office. I've got my coffee. I'm still in my trackies / pajamas. Basically, I've discovered that I have a range of clothes, to be honest, which I've been easing my way into COVID wear for about the last 10 years, to be honest. There is a very fine differentiation between what are my day clothes and what are my pajamas. And of what I've noticed in the past, even though they look the same, like normally I'd at least put on a fresh pair of clothes, you know, when you get up the next day, even if they still look like pajamas. Whereas what I've found now is yesterday's clothes can be sleeping clothes, and then they can just be getting up and being awake in clothes, it turns out.
I don't know how I'm going to go back to a collared shirt. I don't know.
Well, I certainly might not at this stage fit into any of my Gruen wardrobe, so I might have to redress. I was doing a lot of baking, and that seemed like a very productive thing to be doing with your time. But the problem is that my partner, she doesn't really like sweet stuff. So what I found was I was not only doing a lot of baking, but I was also doing a lot of eating the things that I have baked. So I've got to stop baking,
God,
just so I can stop eating.
I've probably trained more in the last 3 months than I have for 2 years at least. I think that, again, when life fell apart, I was like, well, fuck it, I'm going for a run, you know, like, and thank God we're in a part of the world that we were still able to do that during our quarantining. But yeah, it was almost like an old comfortable glove that I went back to.
So you were telling me about the school. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I had a dog emergency and I was doing the right thing by my, constant companions who also, I'll tell you what, the dogs are going to struggle when it is that we have to go back to work because they have loved the 24-hour day attention. In fact, yes, she wants to come into the office now and be part of the podcast. So I'm going to open the door.
From memory, she was part of the podcast last time.
Oh, that's probably right. Yeah, yes, exactly.
She was.
She eventually hears me talking and is like, what's going on in the office? Can I come and be part of that? So that has now happened. So Ramona's here. Winnie will still be in bed. She's a bit more sensible, but Ramona's here.
Okay. No, I think it was just Ramona last time as well. But
you were telling me about the schools, yes. Bang for your buck.
The school was, we found out, I was working in an NGO that was sending volunteers and teachers abroad, occupational therapists, and we found a school that was, we'd already worked with the school in Syria, in Yarmouk. Then we found a school that also wanted to engage with the community of people with disabilities, bring them into a mainstream school. So while I was racing, I would just disappear from a team that we were competing in Europe, and I would not even tell people where I was going. I would just jump on a flight and land in Nairobi and go check out what they were doing. And this one I found was just, it's the Rubin Center. Like if you can't engage with what they do, it's incredible. It's like it's a little paradise in the slum over there. And I would go in there, and the principal, Brother Frank O'Shea, wanted to engage with the community of people with disabilities, bring them into the school. He asked whether or not he could create it in my name, the Kurt Fernley Center. And now I've just been going back every chance that I can. I was meant to spend a week there again in April, but unfortunately everything, the world fell apart. But thankfully over there, the thing that was hurting that school, the thing that was hurting the community was they were worried that they wouldn't be able to feed the kids, to feed the families. So, you know, a quarantine or a lockdown over here means that we have access to job seeker, job keeper. We have access to, you know, government stimulus. A lockdown in the developing world means that you have nothing. But thankfully, we were able to step in during that period of time. A few generous donors were able to support the school with food. So now, well, during that period, it was nervous, but I feel like I'm quietly confident that the school and the kids will be there on the other side of this thing. But you know, the reason to do it is because I was the beneficiary of great teachers. I was the beneficiary of a community that gave me access to sport, education, ahead of my time. And that education and being able to interact with your non-disabled peers, that is life-altering. That is powerful. That is more than a mobility aid, more than access to a wheelchair. The feeling that you are valued is powerful, and I need to play a part in giving that experience to other people.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask, because I was going to say, are the challenges unique in the developing world to, you know, first world challenges? I guess you've answered it in a little, which is because I was, you know, in my head, I immediately went to, of course, the mechanics of it. I'm thinking about in the developing world, the access to technology, to, you know, buildings that have been, you know, purpose built to, you know, facilitate, you know, like people with disabilities, like all those sorts of things. Like, but of course, you've gone to, you know, to the heart of what you're talking about, which is that accessibility to, you know, so talk to me a little more even about that, because I think that is, yeah, counterintuitive, but makes complete sense when you say it, but was counterintuitive to what my initial thought process.
So a lot of people will go into a place where hardship is pretty full on for people with disabilities. So 2/3 of the world who require a wheelchair will never see one. But more important than that wheelchair is access to community. and acceptance into community. So I don't – people may fly in and give wheelchairs and walk away. The wheelchair is 1% of the conversation. You know, I don't care whether a child crawls up to my school or is carried by mum, which the majority of them are, and then given access to it. That is the most important thing. Pushing, hobbling, carried, as long as they come into the gates of that school and feel as if they are wearing a school uniform with their non-disabled peers, that's hands down the most important thing that we need to get over. And that means that we need to convince those who are in the education system, those who are creating either funded through NGOs or governments, we need to make sure that regardless of how disability is funded in community, we need them in the school. So don't just – it's one of those things that if you are in foreign aid, don't just drop in wheelchairs and walk away. Before you drop in a wheelchair, you know, I've landed in these slums, and the best way for me to move around is I have to crawl into them to find the kid. And then I go into a house and that kid is sitting in the corner. You know, that kid is sitting in the corner where they've got a bucket, and that's their toilet, and that's their life in there. So before we drop a wheelchair into this kid, that the wheelchair will be useless, because I'm pretty handy at using a wheelchair, but it's no good for me in there. We need to drop in there and convince family and neighbours and teachers that this person needs access and needs to be able to go outside without shame. So my take on the whole experience of living with a disability in that challenging environment is that we need just more visual access around people with disabilities, and we need education, however that looks like. Not education in a segregated setting. We need the, because then you encourage people with disabilities to, or non-disabled, your peers, to walk by this segregated setting and almost wipe their hands and think, we're done. We need them to see education with community so that there's never an I'm done. There's just, we're figuring it out together.
So that idea of, you know, people having, you know, and you've written about this, you've spoken about this before, and I think we spoke about it last time, which was the incredible support that you got from your community. You know, and perhaps not in the organized fashion that you're trying to organize it for these communities, but just out of an instinctive sense of community, you know, that where you were from and the people that you were surrounded by, there were people who stepped up in those situations and said no, you know, started at your family, went out into your community. The idea that you appreciate that, but then your response to that is to want to do that for other people. Was that always something that was the logical next step of that? Because there's two real approaches you tend to find. There's one person who says, somebody has done me a kindness in my life and I will try to repay them that kindness. And then there's another sort of person who said, someone has done me a kindness in my life. The person who did me the kindness, they don't really need me to repay the kindness. They just need me to thank them for the kindness. They need me to show that kindness for somebody else when they need that kindness. And they're two, you know, they both are nice approaches, but it seems like you've taken that second one, which is, you know, thanking the people by, you know, living the way that they lived, you know, the example that they lived. Was that always something that you planned to do? Did you come to that decision naturally? Was there a moment of revelation that the best way to pay back, you know, the kindness you had been shown was to show that same kindness for others?
I think it just fell into life naturally, that I always thought in sport that I could thank people in my sport 1,000 times. I could buy them a gift, or I could just go out there and nail that sport for as long as I can. And it's the same with the community. I could thank my community 1,000 times, or I could try and create and replicate that community as much and as far as I possibly can. And it's also, when you think about kindness, there's good and bad kindness. So I've received the good kindness. I've received the kindness where my principal would rebel against the Department of Education and demand that I would get a mainstream education. When my mum and dad were told that I'd be segregated, isolated, he would walk into my mum and dad's house and say, ignore the Department of Education, ignore my boss, because Kurt deserves to be at this school. But I've received the bad kindness as well, you know, the kindness where you're not, you know, you're not financially, we weren't very well off, where people would drop a wheelchair at our house and it'd be useless and make me feel useless. I received the kindness, and it sounds weird, but sitting in a street and somebody putting 10 bucks in my pocket, you know, yeah. And that feeling is shit. Like, that is... the last time it happened, I'm a grown man, you know, like, and I think it was a gold market in Dubai, and just these guys went by and put 50 in my pocket. Now, I admit, I kept it and brought breakfast.
But, may as well. If you've been insulted, you might as well at least be full.
But a little girl was also, is a friend of mine. She was given money just the other day, and she's high need cerebral palsy. And she, her mum tried to run and give it back to him, and then she's worried about her daughter who's there just not knowing. And although she may not be able to communicate on the spot, she's able to speak via Facebook and social media. And she was broken that somebody would walk by her and see her and give her a level of pity. And that's not kindness. That's degrading. So there are good kindness and bad kindness, and I try and make sure that I replicate the good one, to make sure that when I'm interacting with the world, with people in the developing world especially, or anywhere around disability, they are not the recipient of you know, anything other than justice, you know? Like, they are my family, and I'm there because I love who they are and I love who they can be.
So take me back to 5 years ago then. So you last time we spoke, very different time of your life, as you said, the last time that you're going to be super focused as, you know, the world-class athlete that you had been and, you know, had become known. I mean, the reason that you've had this opportunity to do these things was because, first and foremost, you excelled, you know, in the sporting arena, and then you use that opportunity to, you know, broaden out and speak for others and provide these opportunities and have this next part of your career. So you're in this race, you know, you've always been one of the greatest, fiercest competitors in the world. One of the great secrets of your success is that you just don't give up no matter what the circumstance. And, you know, you hear it in your mind, 150 from the end, you think, maybe I don't need this in the way that I used to need this anymore. And if this question seems like it's really long, the connection on our Skype seemed to be going in and out a little bit, so I thought I'd just keep talking in the question so that you get the most of the gist. And I was hoping the connection would come back by the end of the question, so it seems like it has.
It has.
So this is the good news. Take me from that moment. You said you raced still for another couple of years after that. Did it change the way you raced and the way that you competed? Had you gone in those last couple of years of competing from one type of competition to playing a different role in your sport? Or was it, you know, I guess what I'm asking is, was there a sense of, okay, I don't have this ruthless desire to necessarily be the best, and that's not how I'm going to define myself anymore, but I am going to continue racing for other reasons? Or did you continue racing because you just didn't know how to stop yet? Why was it that you kept going on?
So it wasn't a maybe I don't have it. It was definitely an absolute. Like, it was, you do not need this. You do not need the win. It didn't take away from the love. So I still loved racing and loved my community, but it just, you do not need the win. Taking that away, though, it was the hardest 2 years. The following 2 years were the hardest 2 years that I've ever had. They were The reason why I raced in the Gold Coast and the Commonwealth Games and would win that gold medal, and just such an incredible moment. And the reason why it was such an incredible moment was 5 months before that, you'd just, you know, the reason why I kept going after Rio was the thought of racing in front of my friends and family for my final time in the green and gold. It was just too much. Regardless of whether or not you need that win, you have to have that moment. And I'd been a part of the Comm Games since we won. I did the final speech when we won the bid to get the games in the Gold Coast. The talking about this whole winning the Gold Coast was about equality and about making sure that people with disabilities were held in equal regard with their able-bodied peers. Like, it was just, I was on board this thing, this event, but training wise, it was tough. It was the first time that I was going to training, and I think it was just before Christmas of 2017. I went to train with my coach, Dorsey. He's coached me since I was 14 years old. I got there and I just said, I don't want to be here anymore. And I pushed away and I just got home that morning and I got out of my racing wheelchair and I didn't want to do it anymore. I just stopped. And I recognized that something was wrong, and it was the first time that I just called you know, my coach, called the Institute of Sport, and just said, I need to talk to someone. I'm not right, you know. And I got onto her name is Fiona, a sports site, and we turned up at the track to have a talk the next day, I think, and she sat down with me and said, how you feeling? I said, I don't even know. You know, I just don't even know. And she goes, what do you want? And I said, I know that I want to go to Gold Coast. I want to go to these games. They're 6 months away. I'm, you know, there's so much attached to it, and I'm athlete ambassador and all of this sort of stuff. I want to be there, but I just can't. And she said, you know that you're good at what you do, don't you? And I said, yeah. No, Kurt. You know that you are fucking brilliant at this thing. And I went, yeah. She goes, Kurt, you are fucking brilliant. Regardless of the result, you are fucking brilliant. Now just go out there tomorrow and show yourself how brilliant you are, and tell yourself that you are good at this thing. And really, it was like I was so overwhelmed. The overwhelmed desire to win wasn't there, so I needed to go back to, you know, the process. And then it was all about, she's like, just remind yourself of why you started racing wheelchairs, you know, like, so it's the story of the older athlete, that when the win, when that absolute just aggressive desire drops off, you go back to why you did it. And why you did it was because you love it. And you wanted to see how strong you could be, and you wanted to see how fast you could be. You enjoyed each, you know, part of each session, and sometimes just reminding you to forget about all of the stresses, just go back to that basic desire and love. And it really helped. And I found that last 6 months, it kind of put me back in a headspace to leave the sport loving it, and to leave the sport with it having a really good impact in my life. And if I would have left the day without talking to Fiona, if I would have not got back into the chair, I would have had a negative taste in my mouth about that sport potentially for the rest of my life. But now, although it feels like that part of my life is dead and buried, like it's finished, it's a lifetime ago, I have such positive emotions to it. And to have went from that place of not even wanting to look at my wheelchair 6 months before and then winning in the Gold Coast with an entire country just buying into the journey that I had, it was incredible. And I did that without that absolute desire to win. I did that with a desire to enjoy each moment.
So I'm fascinated because they say that, you know, professional athletes experience two deaths. And it feels like a trite thing to say when we've been talking about actual death. But, you know, for the sake of this conversation, the saying goes that professional athletes experience two deaths because you experience the death of your sporting career at quite a young age, mostly for people. You know, most professional athletes, you've still got a fair bit of your life still to go when the thing that has defined you for so long and you've focused on for so long is suddenly gone. In those 2 years, were you also making sure that you had everything in place so that when you transitioned out of it, you were ready to go to do something else? Or had you planned to, you know, take a break and work out what that was? When did that, you know, transition into what my life is going to be post, you know, athlete? And I mean, I know you, and I think most people probably have an understanding of that. You know, obviously, you know, your sport, the highest paid sport in the world. You are the, you've clearly only been doing that exclusively for the entire time you've been an athlete. We all know that that is absolutely the case. But no, of course, I know that you've had, you know, a lot of other things going on, you know, during that time out of necessity, but out of, you know, desire as well in your life. But was there a moment where you're like, well, now this is gone, I have to find a new focus for what it is that I'm going to do with my life?
The reason why the voice said that you don't need this anymore, you don't need the win anymore, was because I had enough on the other side of the life. That's how I see it anyway, that family, work, the enjoyment factor had moved, that I had enough going on the outside that I didn't need it. You know, like it's... and. 2016, Harry was 2 years old, and it's one of those things that you're going in that last 200 metres. I saw Harry, and I didn't need to win for him. I didn't need to win at all. I was comfy that there was so much going on, and I had moved on with my life. But we did plan to take 6 months after the games in Gold Coast to disappear. And then when the Gold Coast games finished, you have these ideas that when sport's done, the moment that you take off the green and gold, the phone stops calling. It's in reflection, it was a fairy tale that I thought that the moment that I would stop, the emails would stop coming in, the phone had stopped ringing, so I would disappear with my family for 6 months and come out the other side completely different, you know? But then the moment that I put down the green and gold, the phone calls tripled, the emails tripled.
Well, that was really your own fault as well, though, mate. I mean, you know, you did finish your career with the most memorable and iconic, you know, moment from the entire Commonwealth Games. So if you'd wanted a little free time, you could have come third and maybe the phone wouldn't have rung as much.
Yeah, but for me, that moment was more, that was my thank you to everyone. You know, that was my, that was the perfect race. So I think of four races in my career that are perfect. That one, Gold Coast Marathon, perfect. Average heart rate, 195 beats per minute, maxed out at 211 beats per minute. I buried myself for my own peace of mind and, you know, all intrinsic reasons. And happily, you know, was given the privilege of carrying the flag into the Commonwealth, into the closing ceremony, kind of carrying it into the closing ceremony. And, like, it was massive. But I thought that was like a combined, okay, guys, thanks, and we're done. You know, you think that it's almost, that's the finish line. And then everybody just turns away and moves on. But it didn't. And life escalated. And again, sport is not the most financial. My sports were not signing million-dollar contracts. But then really, the years that followed from 2018, they were really financially lucrative, and you know, building up a public speaking profile that we had too much, that we couldn't handle the amount of work that was coming in. But I, you know, like who I am, you figure it out along the way. You say yes to 10 times as much stuff as what you should, and then you figure out how to get through it at that period of time, right up to March 13, where I was still overwhelmed, incredibly overwhelmed. And that feeling of overwhelmed had been a constant feeling for two straight years. And then she switched off. And I would say that now has made, during this period, has kicked me in the bum to think about what the next few years look like, really. Thankfully, I've been able to just land on my feet. So now sport's been taken away. It was filled up through working with businesses around culture, and you know, the rooms of 500 people and more, the one hour kind of presentation, and then that's taken away. And now it's like, well, shit, I'm not going to sit here and wait for the exit of this. I'm going to create something that exists during this. And there's been a couple of TV shows that I've started to do some work in, but everything works in, I know that my life will be around disability and telling stories and making sure that we, you know, a mixture of both, and making sure that I continue to work around that people with disabilities, as many as we can get to experience the same life that I experienced in my childhood. Yeah, so I would say that I haven't had to think about the creation of a new life, because until March 13.
What was your main message? Not main message necessarily, but when you speak to people, and I imagine that a lot of the time when you're speaking to people, you know, they want to hear both your story, but they're often, I imagine, at events where they're looking for some sort of insight that they can take into their community, into their business, into their own lives. What is the insight that you hope people walk away from when they hear you speak?
Well, like, I think that when we kind of touched on it, what I desire to get across and what's received are sometimes two completely different things.
I've been a stand-up comedian for 25 years, mate. That's the one thing you don't need to tell me.
You have no idea. Yeah, exactly. Like, so I do a gig and I think that it's going towards that direction, and someone will come up and say something completely different. But if I could leave an audience with one thing whenever I speak, it is, I think we spoke about the alternative to it in the beginning when it comes to the social contract, that we don't know when we're wrecking someone's social contract. There's no alarm when we are messing with someone's social contract around discrimination or racial profiling or whatever that may be. We also have no ability to know how we're changing somebody's life in a positive way. My teacher, who rebelled against his employer, he didn't get a gold medal or fireworks or a siren that went off when he walked into my mum and dad's house and told them that I was deserving of an education through Kharkhol Public. He did it anyway. But the repercussions of that one interaction, that would change my life in ways that he would have no idea and I would have no idea until 30 years later, and a strong, independent, resilient person who felt the value of their community has been able to bounce across the world. So if I'm able to have given one thing to one person, it's that encourage them that every interaction that they have on a day-to-day basis has the ability to change someone's world. So why not try and make those interactions, whether it's with a staff member or a kid at school if you're a teacher, or if it's with an NGO, or if you're an occupational therapist with your consumer or person with a disability in front of you, be the person that tries to make that interaction the most powerful interaction in that person's life, so that they leave that moment knowing that there are possibilities at the end of it.
It's amazing when you think about it, because you're absolutely right. You know, your teacher who fought for what he just believed was the right thing. You know, he believed that you should have access to the same thing that everybody else did. And he was willing to, you know, actually fight for it. Not just say it, but actually fight for it. He believed in that. And I bet, is he still with us, or is the timeline on that? He is. I mean, the idea that he believed in that back then, and that's not only resulted in you being able to have the opportunities you've had, but now a bunch of kids in places that never would have had those same opportunities are going to get access to those opportunities. It must be incredibly, you know, pleasing for someone who has dedicated their life to that sort of work and those sort of principles to see the fruits that have been born of the seeds that they planted. So I'm glad that they're around to actually see that and understand that. And I bet it makes them extremely proud when they give themselves a moment to actually reflect on that. So it's a very nice thing, my friend.
Honestly, the response is usually, oh, Kurt, stop talking about it. Yeah. Stop giving me praise. I just did what I had to do. Of course I was going to. You were a little boy who deserved, to be one of my students. But that in itself is worth talking about.
I can't remember when we spoke last time. If I was a more professional podcaster, Kurt, I would have gone back and listened to the episode. But it's not an insult to you. It's an insult to me. I don't like listening to myself. I certainly don't want to go back in a time machine and listen to myself when I didn't know what I was doing on this podcast. Because even now that I do know what I'm doing, I don't want to listen to it. So I like to ask people about their greatest strengths and their greatest weaknesses, or what they perceive them to be. Give me two sets. I'd like your greatest strength and your greatest weakness as an athlete, but then I'd like your greatest strength and your greatest weakness as a, you know, that does not have to do with you as an athlete.
My greatest strength as an athlete was that I could shut down the world for periods of time and just create a person and a persona and a body that could be the absolute best in the world. There was this knowledge that, although it was challenging in that last 6 months and I needed additional help to get into that space, I could just rip parts of me away to make myself stronger. That's probably one of my weaknesses in life, that when I get to a point that's uncomfortable, shit starts falling around, I will shut down and try and do it all myself. And, you know, you need to remind yourself that the reason you've got here is because you've been able to share and people have assisted. So, you know, you can't just shut it down and, you know, not leave the room until you've figured a way through it. You can actually, you know, talk about it and work with people. My greatest weakness as an athlete, I was a pretty good athlete.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the pause that I've met a lot of good athletes in my time. And whenever you ask them what their greatest weakness as an athlete is, like, it's almost like they've never even occurred to them that they might have a weakness as an athlete. It's like you had that same look on your face just then of like, I'm trying to think of something, but I can't. Did you see me, mate? I was really bloody good. I didn't have a lot of weaknesses.
I was pretty good. One of them as an athlete, it was a great strength, is that I could line up against, you know, my best mate in the world and he was my enemy. And just, you would just look at him. It wasn't a person, it was a uniform, but that's also a bit of a weakness. Like, but I would say it's trivial things. Like, I struggled with the discipline around food. Like, you know, like when it would come to that last month and you would have to shut down food, that was a punish. Like, that was, that was just hard work. You know, I love my tucker, and the thought of the just real discipline. But usually I did it. I didn't like it. But yeah, probably actually no. The weakness as an athlete was that when I was racing, that person that I created was a bit of an asshole. I don't want to be that person anymore. And, you know, like, you were just so ultra competitive that nothing else existed outside of that result. And, you know, like, even in the months in the leading up to it, I was a shit partner, you know, like I was a shit, you know, you weren't a great dad because you were buggered all the time. You weren't a good partner because you were just putting every part of yourself selfishly, which I believe you kind of had to do to get those final incremental gains, but you were putting everything into it to create this person, including you were putting other people's parts of other people's life into it as well.
If you could take any skill from anybody in the world, so it can be any skill. It can be, like, you know, a physical skill. It could be a mental skill. It could be capacity to entertain in some way. It can be, you know, the capacity to rebuild an engine and put a car together. I don't really mind what the skill is, but is there a particular skill that you would love if there was a magic wand that you could just have? You don't need to learn how to do it. You don't need to go to a course. And it's just, this is literally a scenario where tap on the shoulder, you suddenly have this ability. What would it be?
Well, yeah, I'd love to build a car. Shit, I'd like to do anything. I would love to build a car, for sure. That would be awesome. But if I could be better at swaying people towards buying into, if I could sway people better towards buying in towards that debate around equality, I would love that. You know, like, I would love to be better at that. To be able to be given 20 minutes and be better at, and it is a skill. Obama was such a good orator that he could talk about a topic and bring people with him, and not everyone. But if I could be better at that, you know, I would love it. I would love it.
Okay, our connection is getting a little bit more poor, so I'm going to finish this up, even though that I could talk to you all day. Thank you so much, firstly, for taking the time to do this. I do want to tell people a little bit about how this happened, because we were just exchanging messages on Twitter, just having a little chat about life or whatever. And then you spoke to me about the fact that you had stopped doing your podcast for a little while. Can we talk about that for a second? Because let's talk about your podcast. And are you back doing it, or have you put it on pause for a minute?
I have, man. I've started going back to it. So I tried to do it. I tried to do it when lockdown, when it first happened. And, like, again, when 90% of life falls over, you're like, all right, I'm going to run out and do more episodes and engage more online and keep that energy going. And then I made the first call over Zoom, and I've just went, this is hard. And also, I don't think I was in the space to have those really fun, positive, enjoyable conversations as well. So I've reached out to a few people, and I'm like, how are you doing it? And what are you doing? And then I tried it, and I just went, this is rubbish. This is shit house. and now that I feel that there is a bit more optimism going, I have started sitting down with people in the same room and talking, and I miss that. And I'm pumped to get that going again, because if I was given the chance to be able to run a marathon tomorrow and go well at it, or sit down and have a yarn with someone for an hour about life. And my podcast is Tiny Island, and I speak about what it is to be an Australian and people's passions and who we are. And I find that conversation often gets hijacked by people who want to utilize it for their own gain, that someone will get up and tell you, this is what it is to be an Australian. And when someone tells you that, there's a reason. They're doing it for a reason. There's gain for them in some way. But sitting down and talking with 100 people, 200 people, with farmers and teachers and comedians, when we're in the same city, but comedians, about who they are, the passions that they have, how they've got to where they are, and who we are as a country, and the good and the bad. I think that we need to have those conversations more often, or else they'll just continually be hijacked by those that are using it for personal gain. So that's where the podcast was born out of. When everything went down, I just thought, I can't do it during this period of time. But thankfully, I'm starting to get up and running again, and I've missed it. Did you see Mark Moran, the WTF podcast?
Mark Moran?
Mark Moran, he lost his partner recently.
That's right, yep.
Did you hear his episode where he spoke about that?
I did, yes. I know Mark, not well, but like he's done this podcast. He was on the podcast after you, though, Kurt. In fact, he said, wouldn't have done it if Kurt hadn't already done it.
Of course.
I think it was what he actually said at the time. But no, I know Mark a little. I know Mark to, you know, say hello and have a chat backstage at a show or something like that. But I've been obviously, you know, this podcast probably wouldn't exist without Mark's podcast existing in the first place, and podcasts like Mark's podcast. You know, there wouldn't have been the capacity in this forum to do these sort of shows. And so that show and he are, you know, people that I have, you know, great affection for. And it's for him to have clearly lost somebody that he had found, you know, immediate comfort and happiness and support with, you know, so soon into their, I mean, it's tragic in any circumstance, but so soon into them, you know, finding something that was genuinely making them both so happy was, you know, a great tragedy. And so say what you were going to say. Sorry.
His ability to grieve openly on his podcast, to share his emotional state at that period of time, his relationship that he conveyed to his audience is the reason why I love podcasting. And you give of yourself in your podcast. I hear when you speak and you give and banging the microphone, but you have a relationship with that audience as well. And I think I love that. I love that this medium creates this audience that have to actually actively seek you out and download you and have that level of engagement. But then, you know, Mark, the way that he openly grieved on his podcast just made me fall in love with this medium even more. That relationship with that medium, with that podcast, is something that I want to emulate. That you can be real, that you can have these real emotions and share with other people lessons and life experiences. And that for me is why I love it. And that's why I'll keep knocking out the podcast.
When it comes to Australia, we are finishing up, but I'm enjoying talking to you and I don't want it to be over. It's nearly over. So when it comes to Australia, it is interesting to me because I do see a great disparity between how we are represented. I feel like there has become a meanness in the way that politics is played. And as you said, the idea of identity has been used and weaponized, and often, you know, somebody's, you know, trying to sell you something or convince you of something. But when you meet ordinary people, I mean, everyday people, I mean, ordinary in the nicest sense of that word, you know, day to day in my interactions with human beings, regardless of political persuasion or any of these things, I mostly meet nice people. Now, maybe I'm naive, but it feels to me that most of the people that, you know, live in this country, you know, understand that we've been incredibly lucky to be born in a place that has such immense natural resources and like a great social system. Don't get me wrong. So many fucking holes in it and so many ways that it could be improved. And for marginalized communities, they'd be saying, well, that's a very nice way of you looking at Australia, Will, but, you know, you're a white middle class, you know, middle-aged man, you know, growing up in a system that was, you know, set to, you know, reward you at every stage, or at least, you know, endorse the idea that you could be successful here. But in a general sense, when I talk to everyday Australians, there is a sense of, you know, the lucky country was originally meant to be an insult. That's actually what it was meant to be. But that most of us felt lucky to be here. But the way that it's played out in the media narrative and the political narrative is it's a sense of entitlement and meanness, a sense of we deserve this and now we need to protect the good stuff that we have rather than feel grateful that we have, you know, through no particular good planning of our own, been lucky enough to be born in the right postcode. So just speak to me a little about, like, if you think there is a big gap, have we got meaner, or are we just being portrayed as being meaner? What's your experience of this?
I think it just depends. It depends on your experience with Australia. It depends on, you can be born 5 minutes from somebody and have a completely different interaction with every part of this community, and it have changed in completely different ways over a period of time. But we all need to hear more about that. You know, like there was a young girl on my podcast, and she was born out at Gilgandra, just a couple of hours away from where I grew up in. Her experience with a small community was chalk and cheese to my experience with community. I grew up thinking that I am in the greatest place on earth because I had a community that banged down doors for me. Tila grew up not even feeling like she is an Australian. She grew up with a community where the coppers drive by my house, I go out and say hello. The coppers drive by her house, her mum says hi. So how do you, and for me, that was a bit of a, during that conversation, it's a bit of an awakening moment where that's where I started to really think about that conflict of social contract, and that mine, that healers, her interaction with community, it affects mine. It devalues my contract as well. And if I am able to do anything to be able to increase that contract, my contract increases in value as well. My contract becomes better. Doesn't take away at all. It builds it. The progression over time, I don't know about you, but I can't go on social media for longer than a couple of minutes nowadays. If people looked at my contribution to things like Twitter over this last probably 4 months, it's gone down to zero, because that's a war zone sometimes. And over the last few periods of After the last few periods, I follow people that I work in the same industry at, but I also follow someone who jumps online and abuses me about something, hoping that I will see a different part of their presence that I can go, okay, there's a bit of light there, you know, like there's a bit of common ground there. But that has meant that my social media, especially over this period of time, has just been chaos. So if I was to read life and think of social medias as real, I would believe that we're falling apart. But my experience with every interaction, every day of the week, conflicts that. My experience with life, when I walk down the street, when I talk to people on the podcast, when I travel around to everywhere, it's not fallen apart yet. So I have to believe that social media, the war zone, is not real. I have to. And that keep tinkering around the edges, supporting those who are tinkering around the edges with their experience, and let's just see this keep rolling. But Yeah, for me over this last 6 months, I've had to really reduce my online presence because that shit ain't healthy.
Mate, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me. Did I ask the time machine question last time? I'm asking it again anyway, but I might not have got to ask you. I don't think it had been in the podcast at that point. So this is a regular question I now ask, which is, I have a time machine. I have a one-way round trip. You can go to any point in your life, observe or change, or you can just go to any point in history, or you know what? You can go to the future if you like as well. It's a time machine. It's one return trip. You don't have to affect things. You can just observe things, or you can try to affect things. Here's what I will say. You don't need to go and kill baby Hitler or stop a war. I have a time machine, and I'm going to send back more qualified people to do that. If I'm going to send back someone to kill baby Hitler, hey, I'm saying you're capable of doing anything, mate. I'm not suggesting that you're not, but I'm just saying if I was sending someone back to kill baby Hitler, it would not be you. I don't feel like you would have it in you to kill a baby anyway. So it doesn't have to be those things. It can be something that is personal to you.
Yep. I would go back to that conversation with my mum and dad. I would avoid them. I would avoid me. But I would go back to my teacher, Mrs. Masters, and Mr. Lom on the moment that they invited me into the school, in the moment that they're cementing Kharkol public, and I would go back there and I would hug the hell out of them. And I would let them know at that point in time that you have just changed my world. Because they were, no matter how much I say it now, they won't believe the power there. But if I pop up the moment that they leave my mum and dad and I just go, you just fucking changed my life. Here's the siren that you deserved. Here's the hug that you should have got. Here's that medal moment that you were worthy of. I would do that. And I feel like it just would be fitting. It would be perfect. Everyone who does those moments, they are deserving of that. They are deserving on the immediate feedback to go, hey, you just did it. You did it now. And I wish I could give it to them. But the time machine as well, I could go back and the first time that I did this podcast, in between recording it and it coming out, I was shitting myself. Nervous as, because again, I love the idea that you can share so much over a period of time, but I think it was at that I just wrote my book during the period of time of writing the book and then receiving all of this emotion from people for sharing that story, and then you share it again on the podcast and you're like, oh my God, what have I said during that period of time? Did I share too much? And I remember it coming out January 26th. It came out and I did listen to it straight away. And I'd had a few beers because it's Australia Day and I race and celebrate, like I celebrate the race, the Oz Day 10K. And I downloaded it immediately because I was nervous. And then just the warmth response that I got from people after that, you know, I'd also go back and just say, chill the fuck out and enjoy the day, Kurt. don't get caught up on those little things. And again, thank you for what you've done with podcasting because you've done pretty well.
Thanks, man. So it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this. I promise when we have an opportunity to be face-to-face, we will do your podcast. I can't believe that I've snuck in and I've cheekily stolen a second one before you got your first one. I feel a little bit bad, but not that bad because I love talking to you and I think people are really going to dig this episode.
Anytime, buddy, and I will. I'm going to chase you down. You're gonna start touring at some point, and I'm just going to sit at the door or at the stage door and not let you in till we're done. But look,
I promise, mate. We will definitely get this done. Certainly, you would be able to chase me down. You're a world-class athlete, and I have bad hips. So
the form's a little bit off, though, Edison. I reckon we're going to be a bit closer than what we once were.
Thank you, mate.